What's up, everybody? Welcome in to another episode of the Celtics Talk podcast. And today, I am the luckiest man in all of New England because while the NBA season is suspended and no one else can hear Mike and Tommy, I've got them in my basement here in quarantine land. Tommy Heinsohn, Mike Gorman, not the way we expected to be hanging out in late April, but I'm thrilled to be here with you guys. Tommy, how's everything? What have you been up to?
Oh, boy, I've been hunkered down in my little house here, been only able to get out of the house four times, twice to get a tooth pulled.
Oh, ooh. You can't smile then, is that what you're telling me?
I'm smiling.
What have you been doing, Tommy, to keep busy?
Well, I've been watching the parade of press conferences to see if we're going to live or pass away. And then I've been drawing. And then I watch Turner Classic Movies. They played, to tell you how bad it's getting, they played Casablanca twice.
And Mike, I think we checked in with you a couple weeks ago. You were hitting golf balls in your backyard. How are you doing during this quarantine time?
Still swinging away in the backyard, doing a lot of yard work. It's funny, the other day, just to get out, I went over to Lowe's, because Lowe's and Home Depot's mm-hmm. are open. And it was just jammed with people. Everybody seemed to have the same idea. Like, I got to go somewhere I can walk around. Nobody was buying anything. People were just walking around, like, you know, looking at drills, looking at whatever you look at in the Lowe's. But that's really the only trip out that I've made in since we came back here after that Milwaukee game was postponed. A couple of runs to a local store to try to get food, stand in line 3 feet, 6 feet away from people with masks on. Most of the stuff where I live now, they won't let you in unless you have both the gloves and masks. They won't let you into any kind of store at all. So it's certainly unlike anything we ever thought we would be experiencing in our lifetime. Just go back to Netflix and watch all those old movies about viruses. that's about all I've done.
I mean, thank goodness for curbside pickup and people bringing stuff to your car. I've tried to use it everywhere. It's almost jarring when they don't have it right now. Tommy, what's the best movie you've watched on Classic Movies? Have you anything good?
Well, like I mentioned, Casablanca has always mm-hmm. been mentioned as one of the top 10 of all time. But they've had a tremendous amount of movies. I'm an old time movie fan. The black and white ones. We're not going to solve all the social issues with Casablanca. It was just a good movie.
Just a good story. You're right. Just a great story.
Mike, are you
to find out there's gambling in here. I'm shocked.
Mike, are you a big TV guy? Are you watching movies, Netflix? What's your your go-to?
I'm an Xbox guy a little bit. So I do waste a lot of time on the Xbox.
Really?
Yeah.
This is stunning to me. I feel like
you know that game, Witcher?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a little bit into role-playing with Witcher for the last week or so.
Wow.
I don't try to go more than like an hour a day, an hour and a half a day, because you can get lost, as you know. Mm-hmm. You can get lost in one of those games, and all of a sudden 5 hours has gone by, and you say, where the heck did that go? So, but my wife has gotten into it too, so it's become kind of a joint activity.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I won't try to get you hooked on Fortnite or any of the the Gordon Hayward-like video games, but I'm glad you're staying active. Yeah.
Is Fortnite, is that a first-person shooter game, or is that a role?
Yes. It's a first-person shooter. It's actually 100 people drop in. You got to survive to the end. I would like to say I'm trying to, like, I've learned because of my kids, but no, my kids have learned because of me, unfortunately. So trying to keep them away from that. Tommy, what have you been drawing? What art projects have you been doing?
Well, I was just about to go out and do some watercolors, sit in my car. I've got the paraphernalia to just sit in my car. And there's a little park here in Wellesley that I can sit at the tail end, nobody bother me, and just go paint the scene looking down at Charles River.
Chris, you wouldn't be aware of this, but for the years, and I mean, how many years, Tommy? 20 years, you and I traveled together on the road. Tommy always had his art stuff with him, always brought it with him. You'd find him in the middle of the day, you go out for a walk, and all of a sudden, if there was a monument, there was Tommy like 25 feet away sketching or painting the monument. And if it rained, you used to tell me, just look out your window and paint out your window in the hotel. So having paints and paintings are part of this man's existence, and they're I'm privileged to have a couple of them hanging in my house.
So I was going to say, before this all went down, I noticed in our green room in our lovely new Boston Media Center, there's pictures Tommy painted of Danny Ainge, or sketched of Danny Ainge, and a couple of those 80 Celtics teams.
Yeah, they were drawings I did for a charity for the Celtics. We sold, and the money went to a charity. I forget what it was. It's been so long ago. But that's my pastime, and it makes the hours while away, you know. So I've been used to, over the course of my lifetime, learned how to do what we've been doing during this emergency. Relax. Totally relax.
Chris, right. I'll tell you a great story.
Do it.
Terry and I get married. Tommy, of course, is at the wedding. I have great pictures of him dancing with Terry. And now six, 8 months go by, and we get invited by Helen, Tommy's wonderful wife, to an art exhibit that Tommy is putting on in a gallery. And so as we're driving out to the gallery, Terry said, you know, something I never told you is I've gone over the wedding list a bunch of times, and we never received any kind of gift from Tommy and Helen. Like, now, that's fine, but it just seems so unlike Tommy. I went through, did I lose something somewhere? She said, I never could find anything. I said, oh, okay. It's just probably a mistake, slipped Tommy's mind. Don't worry about it. So we walk into the gallery, and all these people around, walking around, looking at Tommy's paintings on the wall. And in the middle of the gallery, I'll get choke up with this. In the middle of the gallery, there's an easel with an oil painting of the place that Terry and I got married. And it just said wedding day. And that was his gift.
Aww.
And it's got a prominent place in our house here in South Salem.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool. He's got a good flair for the dramatic, that man right there. He's
good. I set you right up.
I tell you, I was going to do the same for his daughter because she's into art. And unfortunately, the day was so awful. The pictures that I took, I tried several different combinations to come up with a composition, and I never could do it and be satisfied with it. So I took care of it another way.
Tommy, what's your favorite thing you've ever made, sketched, drawn? What is the best art that you're most proud of?
Well, I'm going to tell you, it took me when I first really starting to paint and learn about color. It took me 5 years to finish a painting. And each step that I was involved with this painting, I learned a little bit more about color. And the idea for this painting came when I was coaching the Celtics. I took my players over to San Francisco from Oakland to the big man store called Rochester Clothes. And, you know, it one of the few places in the country where big guys could get clothes. So everybody goes in and makes their purchases. We're ready to leave. And two of the guys say, you know, Tommy, can we just wait a little bit? I really want to get that sport coat. I said, okay, go ahead. So I'm sitting in the seat in the front, ready to drive out of there. And I'm looking at this wall. And it's got all kinds of drippings. It's shadows on it and a whole bit. Well, I always took my Polaroid camera with me to take pictures. So I took a picture of this. And the next day we went to LA and I did a little watercolor of the photograph, the wall of Rochester Clothes. And Rochester Clothes, it took me 5 years to learn how to do this, but it became my signature painting to go into different art associations, what have you. At one point, I was asked to contribute a painting for a show by Charles Bronson, the actor.
Yeah.
And it was for a breast cancer. His wife had died of breast cancer. Now, Bronson was an artist himself. And so I said, sure. And I sent the Rochester Clothes painting down to the show in New York, and I go with my wife to follow at the end of the week to the show, and I walk in, and there's my painting on the wall, and directly opposite my painting was Winston Churchill. The name of the show was Twice Gifted, and they had people that were known for other things. And Winston Churchill was a great artist, that one of my heroes.
Wow.
Wow. I never heard that one. That's good. That's a great story.
Bill Doyle, one of the writer for the Worcester Telegram, often says when we're golfing, Mike, that imagine what we could accomplish if we took all the time we put into golf and put it towards something useful. Mm-hmm. And I know, like, it's fair. Like, I mean, I feel like if we took an art project and invested 4 hours a day, but how much do you miss being out there and having that relief valve of just playing some golf?
Yeah, I miss it a lot. I'm really looking forward to the new rules we have to play under, because I like playing alone. I love to play golf by myself. You know, if I can get out there on the course and sneak on the back nine and play 9 or 10 holes and never see anybody else, I'm really happy. So these new rules that we have to stay 3 to 6 feet apart from people, that's okay with me. I'll be 6 to 9. Yeah, my wife tells me I've been practicing social distance for about 20 years. So I'm pretty good at it right now. But yeah, I do miss that. I'm looking forward to that. The weather just won't cooperate here, though.
Yeah, I mean.
I wake up this morning, it's 39 degrees. You're like, are you kidding me?
Tommy, I asked Mike last time when he was on the podcast about watching old games and hearing yourself calling them. One of the things I've been marveling at during our Classic Celtics series is, regardless if it was a game we broadcast on our network or if it was one of the CBS, NBA on CBS, you are always on the call. Have you watched any of these old games? What do you think, listening back to yourself? It's to me, it's like nothing really changes.
I did the seventh game of the Celtics-Hawks series, and where it became a shootout between Bird and
Dominique.
I listened to that, and I said, boy, that was pretty good.
Who is that guy?
Doing this CBS broadcast was a different experience. I mean, Mike and I have been broadcasting so long, and we got a feel for the flow of the game. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't kill the game with conversation. We try to keep people interested in seeing the picture and coordinate what we're saying with the picture, not to describe the picture. But at CBS, boy, you had to be on every chance you had to get into the broadcast. And I was working with Dick Stockton, who his nickname at CBS at the time was the Heisman Trophy, because when he's doing a broadcast and you interrupt what he's saying, or you're going to interrupt, he puts his hand over straight out. So they called him the Heisman Trophy. It was difficult. Mike never put his hand up. But what he can complain about with me is I give him an elbow every once in a while.
Right. Never has a loose ball made it past Tommy to get to me in like 100,000 games. Never.
Tommy, one of the things I hear often is that how in the world did they let the Celtics broadcaster call Celtics Lakers, Celtics, whatever the case may be? Did you have to avoid being so around the team? I don't know, like, not being biased.
You couldn't win in that situation. I found out. But the way I was doing the CBS broadcast, unlike doing a Celtic broadcast, the CBS broadcast, I would get scouting reports. And I would prepare myself bring up how each team was going to try and beat the other team by working on their weaknesses. Well, that's the first time that the Laker fans ever found out the Lakers had a weakness. So, of course, they thought that I was just bad-mouthing the Lakers. I was doing the same thing to the Celtics. Mm-hmm. And at one point, we had a little fun with the whole thought of me doing this series, and they got me a tie, which was purple on one side and green on the other, so that it showed that I was 50-50 with each team.
Mike, you mentioned that you and Tommy and the chemistry. So next year, 40 years, What are some of your favorite memories? Like, what jumps to mind when
you got about 3 hours, 4 hours?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, we got nothing else to do, so I'm kind of putting you in a hard spot here. But run down what it's been like.
It was just the experience. You know, I grew up in Dorchester, and I used to sell the Record American on Sunday nights and on a street corner down the Ponset Circle for the Dorchesterites who might be listening. And I'd look at the box scores of these guys who had played the night before in Minneapolis or somewhere else. And so I followed the team as a teenager, like religiously. And we used to, this is true, we used to go to the garden, me and my buddies, and we'd climb up the fire escape in the old Boston Garden and bang on the door on the third floor. And one or two things either happened, either a cop or an usher opened the door, at which point you went right back down the fire escape as fast as you could. But if some fan just heard you banging, came over and opened the door, then you were in the building. And Tommy, you remember well, in those days, there weren't that many people. It wasn't 13909 every night. And so you'd work your way down, and by the fourth quarter, we'd be sitting like five rows behind the bench, and I would be watching Tommy play and watching Coos play. So to do that, and then to someday later in my life, be sitting next to this guy and doing games. And, you know, again, I'm repetitive with a lot of these stories, but the very first Celtic game we ever did together, he came in, he took one look at my notes that were in front of me, he rolled them up in a ball and threw them off the first balcony. And he said, "We're going to talk about what happens in front of us." And that's what we've been doing for the last 40 years, to you, right? We're talking about what happens in front of us.
Tommy, how long did it take you to warm up to Mike?
Oh, Mike is, I mean, you know, Mike, you can warm up to Mike in 2 minutes. You know, I mean, he's just a wonderful person. And what goes on in the broadcast is, I think that I've worked with other people, and like I'm talking about Dick Stockton with the Heisman. Can you imagine working with a guy like that, that wants to cut off what you're saying, it distracts you from your thought? And then I worked with some other guys that really were radio broadcasters, so that they would talk about the game like they were on the radio. So they were not doing a regular TV broadcast. So they were doing a radio broadcast, and they were describing a picture of what was happening on the floor when it was a picture already on the screen. And they didn't enhance the picture. And most of them talked forever. So you there was really no rhythm to your broadcast. So working with Mike at that particular point, I mean, we just get in and get out and make a statement. We try and make that let the game breathe so that people reorient to the picture. You know, what I try to do is give people clues as to how one team is going to beat the other, and then augment it through a great producer and director. We had Paul Lucy, who's been around this thing a long time, who enhances what we're saying with some replays that go along with what we're saying. So the way I feel the broadcast ends up, when we do that and we're successful, the guy watching the game thinks he thought of this for the first time. All right, look at, I discovered this idea. And anybody that goes into a broadcasting like with a background like mine, the first thing I say to them when they ask me, you know, for advice, and I'd say, look, you know a great deal about basketball. I mean, the average person is not going to come anywhere close to what you know. I'm going to project a situation where you understand what I'm going to try get you to do on the air. Imagine you're at a cocktail party, and there are three women standing there, and they're talking to you about basketball. I mean, would you be talking about double picks and rolls and this and that and the other thing? I said, just picture in your mind a woman that's hearing about this for the first time, and keep it simple, stupid, so people can get into the sport. A lot of guys with my type of background try to awe you with their Einstein knowledge of the game of basketball.
Mike, you said he kind of throws a couple elbows every now and then. What
he still boxes out on just about every shot. Yeah, that's a given. That's a given. I'll tell you, the only I can remember during the first years with Tom Urey, clearly I was, and still to this day, remain in awe of the man in general. But at that time, I was very much was intimidated, not intimidated, because Tommy never intimidated me on purpose, but just to be with Tommy Heinsohn was mm-hmm. that's all I needed to know. But we're about, I don't know, Tommy, 6-7 years into our relationship. And I always used to say to him, is there anything I can do better? Is there anything I can do to help? And he'd always go, no, we're fine. We're fine. We're good. We're good. So this time I asked him, he goes, yeah, there is one thing. I'm like, oh, he said, you need to be more whimsical. And I was like, whimsical, a little more whimsy you need in your broadcasting style. And that's when I think we became Mike and Tommy. Up until that point, Tommy was the color analyst. I was the play-by-play guy. After that, it became two guys who liked each other watching the game together. You agree with that, T?
So when I first started broadcasting, I roomed with Johnny Most because we did the contract was 25 games, all road games. So I roomed with Johnny Most, and he was, of course, a friend of mine from my playing days and my coaching days. So I got one of the best educations about broadcasting. And what he said is, Tommy, do not forget ever. You've got to also entertain. It's just not a basketball game. It's an entertainment experience. And he came up with nicknames and the whole bit. And he explained how he did it and why he did it. And he had his own particular style. And that's what Mike and I were fortunate enough to develop. We have some great laughs on doing the games.
Yeah, we do. If we don't walk away from a broadcast, I say we, Tommy and I, if we don't walk away from a broadcast thinking that we've made you laugh 4 or 5 times over the last couple of hours, we probably haven't done a very good job.
Well, I think you succeed more nights than not. I don't mean to, if I haven't told you this story, my earliest memory of watching the Celtics, for whatever reason, I remember it was a Celtics-Sixers game. I remember Charles Barkley being out there and my dad is trying to tell me, you know, what's going on and kind of get me up to speed on the Celtics lore. But I remember the only thing that really stuck with me is he said, these two guys here, Mike and Tommy, are the best in the business. And I think that was like 87, 88. And of course, I'm just like, can I go play video games? Never in my wildest imagination did I ever think that I would get to be part of that broadcast. And I can tell you that when I got thrown into, you know, when Abby's out pregnant and I got thrown into sideline, I have never been more nervous in my life because I'm thinking, just don't mess up how good these two are with something that you say that's silly or, and I don't know, I was just way too nervous. It is an honor, even on Zoom conferences, to be alongside you guys. And I hope you understand what it means to be a part of that. So I really appreciate that.
Thank I'm you. Going to give you a pat on the back. My girlfriend thinks you're great.
I'll take anything I can get at this stage because
I don't think I'm great. She thinks you're great.
Well, it's funny because you're sitting there saying that you need to kind of keep it simple, and I'm thinking here I am throwing out advanced analytics and points per play, and people sometimes I think people's heads kind of get lost in all of that, but. In the modern age, hopefully we're trying to expose them to more stats and stuff like that. I'll tell you
a story about Red Auerbach. You know, they got all these analytics and they got, and they really study them and they use the percentages and this, that, and the other thing. What's my favorite one that I hate is what after the game? What's
plus
the
minus. Plus minus?
Plus minus, yes.
Yeah, and I scratch my head because I can't fathom that one. All I know is that Red Auerbach would sit there and they'd say, well, why do you play Casey Jones? He says, he's not that great a basketball player. Why do you play Casey Jones? And he said, because every time I put him in and take him out, we go ahead. That's why. And that's what you're looking for. You don't have to come up with the analytics.
Hey there, it's Tom Haberstroh, your NBC Sports National NBA Insider and host of the Haberstroh Podcast. With all the talk about Michael Jordan and NBCSN showcasing some Olympic classics. I talked to Warriors Hall of Famer, NBC Sports Bay Area analyst, and member of the 92 Dream Team, Chris Mullen. Mully gives me his best Michael Jordan stories and all the memories of the Dream Team, and he reveals the craziest sports Zoom meeting of all time.
Jim Brown was on it, Jerry West, Oscar Robertson.
So download The Haber Show wherever you listen to podcasts.
Tommy, later this week, it is the 64th anniversary, I believe, of the draft day that got Russell, you, and Casey Jones. What do you remember from drafting? Did you know how much talent you guys had pulled in that draft, that 56 draft?
Well, first of all, it was the most unusual draft the Celtics ever had. Number one, to start the draft, they had what they called the territorial pick. So anybody that played their collegiate ball within a 75-mile radius of the major league city, that team could draft him before the draft started. And the reason they did that is to try and capitalize on the exposure that that player had in that market. So I went to Holy Cross, and I fit the bill. So I was picked the first pick of the Celtics. Red had been tipped off about Russell from his coach, a college coach who played USF, and from Fat Freddie Scolari, who was a former player who lived in San Francisco. And so when they came to talk to me, I almost went and played for the Peoria Cats because Red Auerbach didn't seem like he was really too interested in me. He'd always put a knock on me some way in the press. Well, they don't want me. There was a guy that was at the Holy Cross grad that was with the Peoria Caterpillars. And they offered me a job in labor management to go and play and have a regular business job. And I got back, and it was in the paper that I went, and Cousy gets me on the phone. And I said, they got to talk to you down in Boston. I said, well, Red doesn't seem to be interested in me. He said, oh, no, they're very interested. So anyway, it happened. Now the challenge was Russell, because Russell had won all these championships, and there was still big question marks in people's head. And Red talked to me the day I went down there. And he asked me about Russell. And I played him in a holiday festival. And we were up 11 points at halftime. And then we lost the game. So he said, what about Bill Russell? I said, Red, let me tell you, this guy couldn't hit the backboard at times. But defensively, he's the only guy that ever blocked my shot. And he did it several times. And I said, and he's very competitive, and what a pick you're going to get if you can get him. So ultimately, the way they got him is they actually got the Hawks pick, which was the third pick in the draft, because Red had traded Ed McCauley and Cliff Hagan to get the rights from St. Louis. But he had to get past Rochester, who had the higher pick. And they went, Walter Brown, the owner, went to the owner of the Rochester Royals and said, what can we do that we can get Russell? We're interested in Russell. And they came up with a deal that Walter Brown, who was a stockholder in the Ice Capades, they asked Walter, they'd make the deal and not take Russell if Walter Brown would get them a week of the Ice Capades for their building in Rochester. So Russell was traded, and we got Russell because they made a trade of the Ice Capades. Now, nobody ever made a trade like that, but it was okay by the commissioner.
Mike, what was it like going to, I'm assuming you were, as a young kid, you were trying to bust into those were the sort of games you were trying to bust into, right? Like, What was it like? Did you know immediately that Russell was transcendent, that Tommy was going to be the player that he was going to be?
You knew that Russell was transcendent because of the way he, the ferocity, I guess is the word, that he played on the defensive end. Like he really protected the goal like a goalie. And there just weren't any other people necessarily in the league that were doing that. I mean, this was a league where on a regular night, you know, Tommy and the Celtics would beat the Knicks 138 to 132 in regulation. You know, I mean, they were just, you had 170 points in the game. I remember against Minneapolis one time. I can see myself sitting on the corner where I'm supposed to be selling the papers to traffic. I'm looking at this box score where they scored 170 or something the night before. So, I mean, it was a thrill because I'm watching Cousy play. I'm watching Russell play. I'm watching Tommy play. I'm watching the Jones boys play. That was just, you had so many good players on your team, Tom. There's never been a team like that team. And how many guys you got in the Hall of Fame off that team? Like seven, eight?
Eight guys.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. That'll never happen again.
And Tom, did you know, like, what were practices like? Did you, again, I think people forget that the team had some success when Red first got there, but I mean, to win what, 9 out of 10 years or whatever it was in the immediate aftermath of you and Russell, what were those practices like? Did you know how good those teams were immediately?
How good the team was, did you say? Oh, after a while, you know, I mean, when Russell came, I ended up being Rookie of the Year. And Russell really revolutionized the game. And it was quite obvious that he was going to be a terrific player. And Russell made a statement to me. Now, this is a difficult thing. Russell, when I got the envelope and a check fell out, and he got dressed in the locker room next to me, he said, "What's that for?" I said, "Well, they gave me the Rookie of the Year award." So he said to me, "You should give me half of that." He said, "If I've been here since the beginning of the year, you never would have got it." And I went, "Oh, yeah." Well, Russell could do stuff like that, but he was so great a competitor. I mean, he did the most unusual things I've ever seen on a basketball court. One instance is against Wilt Chamberlain at the Garden in a final game of a series. Russell had 5 fouls, and it was like a 2-point game. And Russell, now they're going to try and foul Russell out. So the last 2 plays of the game, you knew were going to go out, particularly the last play, was going to go to Chamberlain. All right. And Russell had said before that game, "I'm going to push him out a little bit further than I normally try to do. And so I'll have some room to try and block the shot." Well, he did exactly that. And Chamberlain wheeled around to roll the ball down his fingertips into the basket, which was, nobody could stop that. He'd go right over you. And Russell blocked that shot. Chamberlain released the ball that far away from the rim, and Russell's hand went up and blocked it just as it came out of his head. I mean, I know that thing, the timing of that was absolutely sensational. He did it with 5 fouls. I mean, whoa.
Do you ever think what life would be like if you had ended up with the Peoria Caterpillars and what you might be doing now?
Who knows? I mean, I had great joy playing for the Celtics. The fun part about it is everybody on that team was very competitive, and they wanted to win. And the spirit of that team still carries on at different places with different teams. I think when they had Isaiah Thomas here, that team had – the sort of spirit we had. There was nobody worrying, you know, going to try and score 40 points so that I look good. They'd try and score 40 points so they won. And they gave the ball up to each other. This team also that they have now has a willingness to do that. And that's a big thing for watching the sport. When you see people gather together and play humble basketball.
Mike, last thing for me. What have you been watching the Michael Jordan documentary?
And no, I think this went longer than the Michael Jordan documentary.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the clock, and what are your impressions, I guess, or what do you remember from Michael covering and from broadcasting those games?
In a nutshell, actually never thought he was as good as people made him out to be until he got that 64 against us, Tom, and you and I did that game. Then I became a believer in Michael Jordan. Had a good supporting cast. I think sometimes people forget how good a supporting cast he had, but obviously a great player. And obviously, in my mind, in the discussion with Russell and LeBron James, and he, as those would be my three guys that I say you could make a big argument with. He had not necessarily the best player of their time, but had the most influence on the game. No, and that's where I think Russell ultimately wins, because he changed the way the game was played. Michael raised the way the game was played. Bill changed it. Mm-hmm.
Tommy, what were your impressions of Michael? And then I'll get you guys out of here.
Well, the outstanding thing about him was he's a competitor boy. He had the ability to take over and make something happen in a positive way with his great athletic ability. Just like I talked about Russell blocking that shot. This guy, when you play against a guy like Michael Jordan, I mean, you feel like you're going to get machine guns, all right? Because a guy like that is impossible to stop. They will the ball in the basket, all right? And they just are so positive and so confident that you get blown away with the willpower. And he was that type of player, and he did it in every game. A lot of guys can do that occasionally, but he did that in every game.
Yeah, I missed last night. I haven't looked at that yet, but on the first 2 hours of the documentary, I thought to see Larry Bird speak in awe of the performance of this guy really made you understand how good Jordan was. Because, I mean, Larry was, in a couple of quotes there, was speechless in trying to describe how good, what a competitor, just how good this guy was.
God disguised as Michael Jordan. It's a great line. I mean, just that watching that game back, just incredible, especially how young he was in the league at that point and how good those Celtics teams were.
Let me tell you one thing, because I hate when people, you know, that they all come off that Jordan is the greatest game that ever, a guy that ever played the game. The object of the game is to win. Bill Russell revolutionized the game. But in addition to that, he won two NCAA championships. He won an Olympic gold medal when he was the key on that team. And he won 11 championships in 13 years. And there is nobody that ever played against him who wouldn't tell you that he's the greatest player they saw. All right? Because take my word for it, we would have never won all those titles without Bill Russell. He was the dominating influence. Cousy was great, but Russell was, you know, like Mike said, revolutionized the game.
All right, there you have it. Mike and Tommy, we're going to pause the conversation right now. We're going to come back with them in a week's time. We got something special planned. Right before the season got suspended, we crossed a milestone with Tommy and Mike. We'll get into that next week, but you can stay tuned. Go in the meantime, press like, subscribe. If you're listening on the podcast app, leave a 5-star review. Let us know how you like Mike and Tommy on there. Leave a little comment. Thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed hearing Mike and Tommy's voice. It's nice with the season suspended to finally hear from them again. Come back next week. We got even more fun planned. We'll see you next time on the Celtics Talk Podcast.